Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, the Thursday edition. Yes, we begin with Colonel Vindman. You will have it memorized. You must have it memorized because I want his words ringing in your ears as you go into the voting booth or vote by mail or however you are going to exercise the franchise in November of 2020. Are things getting better? No, they're getting worse. Did he tell his dad it would be okay? He believed it. Now we all know nothing seems okay. The words of Colonel Vindman in the impeachment hearing of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. So I err in Concord, New Hampshire, and then we send our show up around the country on the Pacifica Network. I used to be a writer for the Boston Globe. I wrote for the Globe, and I wrote a biweekly column up in the New Hampshire section. So I've spent a lot of time. I went to Harvard. Boston's really important to me. We're like a suburb of Boston, the Southern Tier. So I saw an article at the New York Times, and it was written by Ellen Berry. She is the New England bureau chief. She is a phenomenal writer. The title of her piece was, "In a Crowded City, Leaders Struggle to Separate the Sick from the Well." Chelsea, Massachusetts has an infection rate higher than any other community in the state. With families in cramped housing, it is difficult to contain the spread. Joining me right now is Ellen Berry. Ellen, this is heartbreaking, this story. And as I was reading it, we're going to be talking about the density of the population, the poverty of the population, the immigrants that live in that population. But in a bizarre way, I kept thinking of the federal prison, and they have nowhere to go. And even though there's no lock on the door, and we're talking about a community called Chelsea, the same kind of fear and frustration and where do you go seem to be playing out in Chelsea, just the way it's playing out in prisons across the country. So welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's explain Chelsea to the audience, because they may not be as familiar as you and I are, but as soon as I saw Chelsea, I knew exactly what you'd be writing about.
Right. So Chelsea is like a little pocket of cheap housing next to Boston. It's 2 miles and it's home to about 40,000 people, which makes it the second most densely populated city in Massachusetts. It's surrounded on three sides by water, which kind of contributes to the feeling of it being a little bit of an island, like its own space. And it is home to a lot of undocumented workers. Some people have suggested that that is also because it is separate. Not a lot of people pass through Chelsea because it's an enclave.
Right. And in that way, it has the illusion of safety. I mean, you're also in Massachusetts, where Massachusetts is not like some other states, but there is this idea that somehow it is an enclave and that nobody will be knocking on your door because they'd really have to go out of their way to come to Chelsea. But let's talk about the problems right now. You talk about cheap housing. But that doesn't really tell the story, because this is not a story only about sheep. It's a story about an incredible density and where people are living. They're not just living in apartments. They're living on porches. They're living in closets. Explain to people what it means to live in Chelsea, because it isn't like you and I would imagine renting an apartment.
Right. So there's a very large housing stock of triple deckers that were built in the 1940s or before then. And within those triple deckers, there is an enormous amount of illegal subdivision. So when housing inspectors look at this housing stock, they find that there's a lock on pretty much every door that there can be, because whole families, sometimes multi-generational families, are living in single rooms in apartments. They're living in closets. They're living in unfinished basements. And they're living, as you said, on porches. Anywhere there is space, there are people.
We know that it has the highest per capita density of COVID-19 cases. And at least that's what you suggest in this article. Am I correct? At least in Massachusetts.
I mean, it's off the charts.
It's off the, but so how do we know that?
How do we hear about 3 weeks ago that the numbers in Chelsea were not like any other community in the state? They're now, I guess, around seven times the state average.
I'm going to read directly from your article. Mm-hmm. Chelsea is the epicenter of the coronavirus crisis in Massachusetts, with rates of infection that surged last week to 3,841 per 100,000, six times the statewide average. And officials fear the virus is still spreading. So I guess I'm going to start with this. So who's doing the testing? I mean, one of the biggest issues that we're here, testing, that they know this already. Is this because there was a community that went into Chelsea because they already began to fear what was happening there? Did the public health officials target Chelsea and say, we better begin to look here because we know almost by definition that this will be a hot spot?
Yes. So starting around 3 weeks ago, it became clear that this was a reservoir of infection, and there began a kind of campaign of door-to-door testing in public housing. For example, Chelsea is also home to a soldier's home. So I think it has four nursing homes. So that has also really ratcheted up the number of deaths because there are infections within the nursing homes. But the nursing homes are in a way their own separate story. There has been a lot of testing now in affordable housing, high rises, and public housing. And it looks like the numbers there are not as high as the population at large. So it seems like a lot of what we're looking at is clusters of cases in rented rooms in triple deckers.
Oh, God. One of the issues that I should have focused on was the problem is, so now that you have people that are being tested, now that you have all these positive cases, you know where they're going. And they're going to places where they can't isolate, okay? Just the density, the nature of how they live, it means there's a challenge to isolate. But you point out the problem right now is that because of privacy laws, we may know there are lots of numbers, but we're not allowed to specifically identify who is someone who has tested positive. So there almost becomes this sort of incredible fear of your neighbor, because one, you don't want to share that information if you know it yourself, because you don't want to then be marginalized. At the same time, how do you reach out and help people when there are all these privacy issues that surround them as well? So it's kind of a catch-22, Ellen.
Yeah. So there were two big complaints that I heard from officials there. One is that in multi-unit housing, the Department of Public Health does not share which units the infections are in, you know, because EMTs really wanted to know if they were going to a call where someone was infected. The DPH does share street addresses, but not unit numbers. So if you have, you know, 200 units in a building, it's a little bit of a black box. And because you have high rises that are set aside for elderly disabled people, they may know that there's, you know, let's say 25 positive cases in the building, but they have no idea where those are. So that's one complaint. And then the other complaint is when someone's infected, we can't tell them to separate from their family. And most people, given the choice, will not.
What you don't know is that my daughter lives in China. I am now living sort of COVID-19 numero due, because I experienced it with her in the late fall and early winter as she was telling me what was happening in China.
Yeah.
And I was bringing in some of those recommendations of what I heard the Chinese were doing. Of course, it's a very authoritarian country. Mm-hmm. But one of the things they did, you actually talk about in your article. And what they were able to do, because they're authoritarian, was that if you tested positive, you did not go home. It wasn't a choice. You went into either a hotel or these dorm-like settings or these settings where there were like 100 beds, but you did not go home. And they basically warehoused everyone who tested positive together. So they didn't go home and infect their family. They didn't go home and infect their children. They stayed there until they tested negative twice, and then they were able to return home. Well, that makes so much sense, because you don't want your grandparents to get ill. You don't want your children to get ill. They have made that offer to people who have tested positive in Chelsea. Share with my audience the response. Because that blew me away. I was so upset. Go on.
Right. So you got to give Chelsea some credit that that being able to offer free hotel rooms, actually in the Quality Inn in Revere, it's one of the first communities in the United States to offer that, not to homeless people, but to people
who are positive,
infecting their families.
Right.
And what they get is they get 3 meals a day. They get medical care, no questions asked about immigration status. I'm not sure they even record that information. And you would stay there until you were cleared to go home. I mean, it sounds like a pretty cushy lifestyle, but in the first week they made this offer, they only had 14 people stay there.
When I saw that number, I was like heartbroken. I was like, oh, send me down. I'll hold their hands. I'll talk to them. But explain why so few people exercise the choice.
Yeah, like I actually think this is a manageable problem. It's partly just perception. It's a new idea that you would be able to stay in a hotel until you felt better. And I think people are scared. This is a community where there's a lot of undocumented people who are afraid even to admit that they have symptoms, much less, you know, turn themselves over to the state for, you know, 2 weeks of housing. So I just think fear is a big part of it. And then people just want to stay with their family. The problem is they're infecting their family.
Exactly. And
if you live in a 3-bedroom house in the suburbs, you can lock yourself away, maybe. If you have 9 people in a 3-bedroom apartment in Chelsea, one of you gets sick, you're all going to get sick. And I heard really unnerving stories from people who were renting rooms about, I heard my neighbor coughing. 3-4 days later, we were all sick. And she said, I don't think there's anything we could have possibly done to protect ourselves, because I think the air was contaminated. When you live in small closed spaces, I mean, we're learning a lot more about the virus now. It's aerosolized. And I think especially in March, during the weeks after the lockdown, the government was telling people to go home and close the door, and they were infecting each other. They were locking sick people in with well people. And in a place like Chelsea, that means you'll have a whole new wave of infection.
The other thing is, because most of them still have to work, so they're not only bringing it home, they're bringing it to their work site. A lot of them don't have the PPEs. Most of us don't have the PPEs. So it's really hard for them to protect themselves. But as you point out in your article, you might hear someone coughing. You might sort of evict them from their room. And
right.
So that's the, tell them that story. I mean, that was the other story, that you find people in basements, you find people on the floor because people are being asked to leave because everyone is afraid of everyone else.
Right. So these are pretty upsetting stories because they just sort of don't fit the way we think of life in our city. But it was happening regularly in Chelsea that people would come home and out of a sense of ethics and responsibility, they would tell their roommates that they had thrown a positive and they would get evicted. One gentleman was told to sleep in an unfinished freezing basement. I mean, it was still snowing at night at that time, and he was writing out the illness on a piece of cardboard in the basement. One guy voluntarily started sleeping in his car because he wanted to stay away from his family. And his family finally, you know, desperately worried, contacted the city to say, find some housing for him. And then the third story I heard was about a gentleman who was told to sleep on an open porch.
Oh, God. You mentioned that so few people exercise the option of going to the motel. When you wrote the piece, you mentioned that only 14 people had done it. And I am trying to figure out how we change that number. As you pointed out, they don't ask any questions. So for those folks who are worried about their immigration status, they don't ask about your status. They just ask, are you positive? That's your passport into the hotel. But is there any assurance that ICE will not come knocking on the door? Is that part of the concern? I mean, I can tell you as a public health official, I am not going to ask the question. I'm going to feed you. I'm going to make sure that you test negative before you leave. Here's the problem. ICE and public health officials don't always work off the same page.
So as far as I know, the information, and this would be the municipal policy, the information not shared with the federal government.
Okay.
Is the fear there? Of course the fear is there.
The other thing was, as I was hearing your story, I had made the same suggestion in New Hampshire, which was so funny. I mean, this is live free or die. I mean, you know, all the crazies live here. And I made the suggestion. And of course, everyone said, well, then I'll never be tested. If that's what you do, if you put me into this sort of warehouse situation, then I will never be tested because I don't want to know and I would not want to go there. Mm-hmm. And I remember listening to him and I'm thinking, I said, well, here's the deal. If you're going into a dorm setting, you know, maybe a big place with lots of beds, you know, I said, Barack, I said, I will take care of you. I said, because if I test positive, I will take care of you. I said, and there are two benefits to going into this kind of setting. One, you're not going home, because even if you had the luxury of a separate floor or a separate bedroom, you and I both know that's not isolated enough. And so you want to protect the family, you want to protect the kids, you want to protect the other people that live in that house. I said, but the other thing that's an advantage there is that we could take care of each other until someone gets so sick that they have to go into the hospital. So what you're constantly doing is it's kind of like a continuum of care, Ellen. I almost want to role model, not just in Chelsea, this kind of behavior, but in order for Chelsea to embrace it, it needs to happen in Brookline. It needs to happen in other places. So they realize this isn't about a stigma. Mm-hmm. It's about safety. It's about protecting those you love.
Yeah, and I think the more it happens, the more people might embrace it and the more they hear about it. Yeah. I think in China, I mean, it's just a completely different kind of culture. But this is not viewed negatively in China.
Not at all.
It was a way to get nursing while you were feeling badly and also to have some company. Because truthfully, I know people who are riding this out with a closed bedroom door, trying to separate from their little kids. And that's hard.
Right. One of the things I have a concern about is that because we focused on Chelsea, and Chelsea is one of the first communities, mm-hmm. what did we just describe? It's density, it's poverty, it's undocumented immigrants. And so we started there. I wanted to start in Concord, New Hampshire, okay? Mm-hmm. Because part of the problem is that it reinforces that this must be a negative. Why are you doing this only for me? And I think that's what I love about what the mayor of New York City did. What the mayor of New York City did when he realized that people were hungry was initially he was feeding the kids who were no longer in school and they were getting they could go to school and pick up 3 meals a day. Then they were feeding their families. And then he realized there were a lot of people that were hungry. And he said, I don't care who comes to school. Whoever comes and picks up a meal, they can get 3 meals a day. I thought that was a brilliant idea. It was generic. It was across the board. It was anyone in the city. I think in order to save places like Chelsea, because there are places all over the country, like Houston with 600,000 undocumented immigrants, we need to create the concept and invite all kinds of folks in, because I would be the first to go there. Mm-hmm. And I would then encourage someone from Chelsea, for example, to join me. Because I think if I can role model it, it isn't a negative, it's a health and safety issue. And that means I don't want anyone to get sick in my family. And I don't want anyone to get sick in yours. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think until we deal with household spread, we're not going to get the rate down to what we need it to be. By shutting down society, you bring it down from a rate of 4 to a rate of 1, but we actually need it to be 0. And household spread is where we are.
And so we talked about the privacy thing. And I'm thinking, if I'm responsible for a building and I know that there are 30 people in my building that have COVID-19, are we going to be able to somehow thread the privacy issue with the safety issue of the community? I know it's a balancing act,
right?
But has the state of Massachusetts, has the public health officials in Massachusetts begun to understand that, how do you weigh these things?
Right.
We realize the consequences are death. The consequences are incredible illness. The consequences are so huge. And this is not necessarily a permanent condition, but it's a condition right now that privacy doesn't seem to weigh so importantly in my head as making sure that people stay alive and stay healthy. So have they had these conversations in Massachusetts about how to make that determination?
I think every state is defining the outer limits of, you know, medical privacy a little bit differently. So for example, EMTs in New York State do get a unit number, and they will know whether that unit is negative or positive.
Okay.
In Massachusetts, they get an address. So within the housing, within the high rise, they don't know who's negative or positive within the high rise. I think this is, I mean, to be fair, our society is dealing with something completely unfamiliar. We have become reflexively very private about all medical information. And now I think no one knows how to deal with it. If you go to your Stop and Shop, for example, a grocery store, and you know there have been cases, and you say, I'm going in here regularly, I need to know how many people are sick, our corporations don't know how to deal with it.
Oh, I know. But you're seeing it in Massachusetts, where it's not a statewide decision, but different cities now are requiring that everyone that works at a grocery store must wear a mask. That people that are going into grocery stores, it's not a statewide phenomena, but it turns out that it is selective based on the city. Well, I was just posting something on Facebook the other day about how I wanted Market Basket in my state to require every single checkout person, bagger, everybody wears a mask, okay? Because virtually nobody was in my store. And so here's what the answer was. Oh, I go to the Hanover Co-op, and everyone in the Hanover Co-op is wearing masks. I go to the Concord Co-op, and I got like my middle fingers up in stereo. I said, do you get it? Do you get it? What you are telling me is the whole problem. It's what the elite always do. They always protect their own. They always protect their stores. They always protect their workers. I want the 90% of us who are going to have to go shopping at a Shaw's or a Market Basket or a Hannaford. And if you expect the employer to make that decision, I'm not sure that's fair. I think if you make it an across-the-board decision, I think it becomes something where then we're all in this boat together, and it reinforces that sense of community that I think right now, that's what's getting frayed by this. And I think government has a role to sort of reinforce how we sort of attack it as one, not as separate fiefdoms.
It's a challenge to our entire kind of culture of individualism and privacy, not here, not just in the US, but also in Europe. These are countries with a very developed culture of individualism.
In a way, there's a part of me, you're thinking I'm crazy, Ellen. I'm a little grateful for the pandemic. And I'm not grateful for the death. I'm not grateful for the cost. I'm not grateful for the economy. But it really is explaining to us how we are on this sort of planet together. It has given us a sense of vulnerability that's across the board. I've been beating the drum about climate change and how climate change really is about all of us. You know, it isn't just about what's happening in Miami, and it isn't just about what's happening in Houston. It's about all of this. And I think for the first time, it's a really interesting opportunity for us to recognize how dependent we are on each other and how maybe our approach of individualism has to be a little bit tempered with what we need to do for each other. And I'm going to say something that I say all the time. It's a great quote from Calvin Coolidge. And my quote that I repeat over and over again is, Calvin Coolidge said, patriotism means looking after yourself by looking after your country. And the reason I love that is that he started with the selfish piece, me. Okay? I care about me. And then he kind of reminded everyone, but if you care about you, then you have to look at the gestalt and you have to protect your nation. And I think that this pandemic is sort of driving us to that. And I hope that the experience in Chelsea is replicated in other places so other people know they don't go home, they go somewhere else, and that will make it easier for Chelsea to save themselves. So thank you so much for writing that piece.
Thank you.
It was powerful and depressing as hell, but I'm grateful. So thank you. Ciao.
Good talking to you.
All right, good talking to you. That's Ellen Berry. She writes for the New York Times. Her piece at the New York Times was about the community of Chelsea, entitled "In a Crowded City, Leaders Struggle to Separate the Sick from the Well." All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back.
The Tale of the Lackawanna River on this current cast. The Lackawanna River in Pennsylvania was once a dumping ground for coal waste and sewage.
Oh, it was a dirty place. It was not some place you wanted to go to have fun.
That's Bernie McGurl of the Lackawanna River Conservation Association. Eventually, the mining companies shut down and sewer treatment plants sprang up, but the damage to the river's reputation had already been done. McGurl says people saw the river as a dumping ground, so the Conservation Association invited the community to help clean up the trash, plant trees, and build trails. Today, people fish, kayak, and bike in and along the river, proving communities can come together to restore natural treasures. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
Silence. Oh, I've been missing silence. No time to look for guidance. Who invited everybody in? I've been so overwhelmed with trying. Don't wanna be at parties. I just wanna be nobody with my thoughts in my room. But it's no use. Still here. Feels like I'm standing in a crowded room, fighting to find a little space to move. Try to remind myself it's nothing new, but taking a breath is getting hard to do. Oh, I'm here again, I'm out on the edge, but can't take the step to get out of my head. I'm here to the end. Maybe I should try to make friends with this crowd. On my own, but no one knows that it feels like I'm standing in a crowded room, fighting to find a little space to move. Try to remind myself it's nothing new, but taking a breath is getting hard to do. Oh, I'm here again, I'm out on the edge, but can't take the step to get out of my head. I'm here to the end. To try to make friends with this crowd. Like I'm standing in a crowded room, fighting to find a little space to move. Try to remind myself it's nothing new, but taking a breath is getting hard to do.
Welcome back to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. My ex-husband's family is from Iowa. My daughter went to the University of Iowa, and for about almost 14 years, I was on Iowa Public Radio with Dr. Politics, also known as Stefan Schmidt. And you know Stefan Schmidt because he is a regular on my radio program now. And even though I don't do Iowa Public Radio, I feel like I'm almost a resident of Iowa. Someone said to me, you need to interview Doug Burns. And I said, who's Doug Burns? And they said, well, on top of being the citizen of the year in 2019, He is the publisher of a group of small newspapers in rural Iowa. And I went, oh, is he surviving? She said, talk to him. So let me welcome to the program Doug Burns, Citizen of the Year. I want to talk to you about why journalism matters, the challenges not only in rural Iowa, but in rural areas everywhere, and why people need to value it now probably more than ever, in part because so many things are falling apart, so many institutions are being challenged, that people need a place that's both reliable, a place that will do the investigation, a place where facts will be sort of established so that as they proceed in their lives, they know what to do. And yet, as you and I both know, Doug, who the hell is buying the ads right now? And how do you monetize what is such a critical, critical thing called journalism at the time of a pandemic? So welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Arnie. And I feel like I'm talking to a fellow Iowan. As we talked about in the lead up to this, you were so ubiquitous on different programs here that when you called, I mean, I know you live in New Hampshire. I'm familiar with your work, but part of me had to question that. I think of you as an Ames, Iowa resident for some of the reasons you've just outlined. So as far as somebody who's never lived in Iowa, you probably know the state as well as anybody with that description.
Trust me. And you know, there's something interesting. As I was reading the comments when you became Citizen of the Year and you sent me the article, it was really beautiful and you're quite remarkable, sir. There was something that you said, I think at the end of the article, and I want to tell you why I loved it. You said, we need to be supporting each other. Let's just try to be a little kinder to each other. Let's try to have more personal interaction and support each other in more of a one-on-one way, Doug. And what's so ironic is now that we're isolating, one-on-one is getting more and more challenging. But you know why I glommed on to that comment that you made? Because I was watching the BBC the other day and they were talking about New Zealand. And there are signs all over New Zealand, thanks to their phenomenal prime minister. And you know what the signs say? Be calm, be kind, COVID-19.
You know, I've talked to several, you know, we're fortunate. We do still have, you know, reasonably good classified ads in rural Iowa. We're a regional trade center in Carroll, Iowa, for a pretty big swath of West Central Iowa. You know, with a mask on, we're an essential business. So the newspaper building could be open, but we've closed it. We have most people working from home. My office is kind of in the back where our press used to be. So I'm able to come in and work here, but I've gone out to the grocery stores to do some stories, you know, socially distancing, have the masks on. Some of the store managers who I know really well, we've made the collective observation that people really are being a lot kinder to each other. I just noticed that in the day-to-day interaction. I mean, this isn't the route we wanted to get to that kindness. I am noticing it, and I hope it sustains.
Let's talk about the challenge for journalism going ahead. So I sent you something that came from my state senators, my U.S. senators, and I'm sure you mentioned that you talked to your U.S. Senator, Joni Ernst.
Same press.
Oh, very perfect. Everyone knows that there has been a consolidation in the media. Everyone knows that there's been a challenge, especially to print journalism, to survive even before the pandemic. And then the pandemic happened and everybody's like, oh my God, no restaurant's going to be advertising. No car dealership is really going to be doing much advertising. And yet now more than ever, because we are in some ways so isolated from each other, we need to sort of figure out what's threading us together. And newspapers actually do that because you can sort of keep us current on what's happening in the areas in which we live, not just what's happening in Washington, not just what's happening with the press conferences, but what's happening in our rural communities. So I want to know what you thought you were going to be able to do as the pandemic started raging, and about what you are hearing now from a number of senators in the U.S. Senate, that they are realizing that we're bailing out hospitals and we're talking about bailing out businesses. But what a number of senators are realizing is this is a time where we need to make sure that we bail out our local and rural papers. And you, for example, are one of them, just like the Concord Monitor in my community is one. What do you think of that idea? And what kind of a bailout would Doug want?
That's a terrific question. First of all, the Paycheck Protection Program is riddled with issues, as that's been, Arnie. For us, it's worked well because we've worked with the same local bank for 90 years, going back to my grandfather and even my great grandfather. Commercial Savings Bank here in Carroll. It's locally chartered, and Ryan Milligan would be, you know, the fourth generation member of his family to helm it. So when the Paycheck Protection Program came out, we were able to get information right away. We were able to sort of pre-fill out what we thought would be the questions. And then 3 minutes after the window opened to submit it, we were one of probably the first businesses in the United States to get in. And it's because I was dealing with a locally owned bank, locally operated bank that cares deeply about the community and knows the value of the paper. So they were able to get my application in and get it approved. So that's worked well. Organizations like Google and Facebook have provided some money that we've been able to access that. So that's mm-hmm. helpful. In terms of very specifically the question you raised, the 73, 74 senators who've signed onto a plan to extend the Paycheck Protection Program, that's good. But also they're trying to direct OMB to delve into work with federal agencies, whether it's the Agriculture Department, whether it's even like the National Guard, to put out public service announcements on any number of items. And that could take the form of a full page newspaper ad or a radio spot on a
local. Yeah, but a PSA, when I think of PSAs, we did PSAs in this radio station. We didn't get any money for it. By definition, usually anything from the government didn't always come with a check. So they're not just talking about the fact that they want the Agriculture Department to do something or the National Guard or public health. They're talking about buying space in your paper. That's a novel concept. And I'm betwixt and between, because I'm a little bit nervous, maybe in part because we have an interesting president named Donald Trump, who wants to sign the checks, you know, and wants to do all these things, that now with the government making this decision and you're needing this cash, that the temptation is this a generic federal ad, government ad, informational ad, or does this take on the trappings of something that feels more like it's serving the current administration as it anticipates a provocative election in 2020. And so while it's a win, yes, you get money, is it a win when you want to make sure that you create sort of a level playing field for your reading audience?
Well, if we get an ad from the federal government and it has a picture of Donald Trump holding a can of Lysol, we will decline that ad. Different levels of government already do this. If you're a county newspaper of record, there's information that comes from the county, from the city, from the school district, information on salaries, information on purchases. So I would really look at this as just sort of an extension of the public record process. And obviously we'll have to review. I would hope it would be, you know, statistics and science and just, you know, basic information in Iowa from, for example, USDA information. I mean, there's a, you know, programs right now that the USDA and the Iowa Department of Agriculture have been working on, you know, because of people basically just having to like kill livestock or dump milk. So trying to get some of that to food banks and, you know, streamline that process. Information on, you know, smart voting, being able to vote by mail or vote at home, you know, information from the SBA. And you know, a lot of the information that we're putting out online, I worry that it's not reaching some of our most vulnerable populations, which would be the Spanish-speaking population that really relies heavily on La Prensa, Spanish language paper, or a lot of our older rural population that doesn't have high-speed internet, is a group of people that don't really have the fluency with the technology. So having this information bought and purchased by the government, as long as, you know, it was, again, science, statistics, basic information, you know, we'll be happy to put that out. And I think that will, you know, help boost our papers, help boost a lot of radio stations. But obviously, if we start getting, you know, recitations of, you know, Lysol and Clorox and the president taking parts of his daily briefings and turning those into ads, you know, we'll have to be very circumspect about whether we run them.
Except, you know, I, as I'm thinking this out, I'm really glad I'm talking to you, because at my first knee-jerk reaction was, okay. But now, as I'm thinking about it, what is replacing private industry? What is replacing a lot? It's the public sector. The public sector is now figuring out, how do we get you healthcare? How do we get you food? How do we get you education? I mean, in a lot of ways, how do we get you PPEs? I mean, how do we get you money so that you can pay the rent? How do you, and in a bizarre way, this is the appropriate time for government to buy ads, because government is filling in all the interstices of the cracks of what now has happened as a result of the economy basically going into the dump. So what I'm saying is that this is an interesting time for government to step in and write those checks, because we need that government information. So in a bizarre way, the government really is replacing the car dealership. The government really is replacing maybe the pharmaceutical company or the health insurance company or the whatever, because it is now filling in all those gaps, because so many of us are unemployed, underemployed, waiting for a check, trying to figure out how to get food. And now as a result of that, this is an appropriate time for government to actually sort of fill in not just the financial gap, but the information gap.
Well, you know, newspapers like ours are sort of the last refuge for collective truth and common discussion, where we have Republicans and Democrats who, I mean, I'm in a county that went heavily for President Trump, and we're an independent newspaper. We've endorsed both Democrats and Republicans, but we're trusted because people are 1 to 2 degrees of separation from most of the local news that we print. So if you run an ad or you have an item in our paper, you accrue credibility by proximity, because that ad or the state story or the, you know, opinion piece from a U.S. senator is next to a council story. It's next to an 8-man football game story. So all of that information you know to be true. You know, newspapers our size are struggling. We, you know, I've gone to some extraordinary lengths to bring in revenue here. We both know about the proliferation of news deserts and rural areas. You know, if you're in a city, you know, there might be a website or a blogger or somebody who can kind of piecemeal different niches together and get you that information. You can't scale those type of things in rural Iowa. So we are actually right now in the process of trying to bifurcate our business. I've talked to my good friend, Congressman Ro Khanna from Silicon Valley, about this. He's been trying to extend tech jobs into rural areas, because all the wealth now has kind of been scooped and segregated in our country to Seattle, Austin, Boston. So we need some of that wealth, that digital wealth and technological wealth, to river back to us. But I've talked with him about, you know, legislation or other action that would allow independently owned newspapers to bifurcate their business model, so that we could have a 501c3, a nonprofit, that would allow us to do government accountability journalism, maybe agriculture reporting, do a deeper dive into the Latino community. And that's really urgent right now with what's happening in meatpacking plants.
Right, exactly.
And the market won't sustain that kind of coverage. I can sustain, you know, maybe a limited amount of sports coverage, a limited amount of local government coverage. And that's really about it. But that's not enough, Arnie.
I know. Oh, you're going to love this. So, Doug, I got fired for the third time on the morning that I got fired in 2006. I was working for a commercial station, and I got fired that morning. And I'll tell you why. And my husband said, you have to go to the National Association or the New Hampshire Association of Broadcasters dinner that night. I'm not going. I said, I got fired that morning. You got to go. Why? Because I was chosen as Broadcaster of the Year that night. I got fired that morning. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because it'll make you smile. You are smiling.
Yeah.
It'll make you smile. Why? Because I didn't have necessarily a model that could be monetized. Because when I would sort of challenge the pharmaceutical industry, then they didn't want to necessarily buy ads. Or when I would challenge, like, maybe, why are you buying an SUV? Then the car dealerships didn't want to buy ads. Or if I wanted to raise questions about something that would, you know, touch on a pillar in the community, but the story needed to be investigated, and I would want to begin to investigate it, then that pillar in the community, who was the head of the Chamber of Commerce, would say, get her off the air. I have experienced on radio what you are talking about, with the kind of investigations that need to happen at the meatpacking plants, at those places where vulnerable populations are really being abused and used, and yet it hurts the whole state, let alone the whole country, if these stories don't emerge. But who the hell is going to pay for them, Doug? And I think your nonprofit suggestion makes sense, but then you need to find a nonprofit funder for that. And that must be your conversation with Ro Khanna.
It is. And, you know, so in many ways, the way forward will require me to function something like a college president, in addition to a newspaper publisher, and become a progressive fundraiser. So yeah, when I was in journalism school at Northwestern in 1991, some of the gray areas that I'm in right now with having to, you know, both report and raise revenue would have been unthinkable a generation ago. But that's where we are right now. So hopefully this program that 3/4 of our U.S. senators back with some boosting of the PPP program, boosting or providing some paid advertising to not just newspapers, but local TV, local radio. I hope that is not just a news release. I hope that evolves out of news release status and talking points to actual reality. I'll believe it when I see it. But beyond that, yeah, we do have to go out and find alternative revenue streams because the commercial model won't work. I do have some confidence that digital subscriptions, we've been working with Facebook as part of a terrific program, a North American Newspaper Accelerator. Mm-hmm. We're in that with the New York or with the Los Angeles Times, Toronto Globe and Mail, Montreal's La Presse, Tampa Bay Times, Little Rock and Memphis, as well as some other papers, and, you know, trying to get more digital subscriptions. There's still some room to grow on the revenue side, but without a nonprofit stream, I don't know how many of us outside of the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post can survive.
So you mentioned that you want to think about bifurcating and creating this sort of 501c3 to do the investigative work and then have the one that's sort of more traditional monetized newspaper. I go to something called theconversation.com all the time, which is a phenomenal site. And what they do is they talk to PhDs and professors and they have them write about their area of expertise. And it's a 501c3. And I go there and then I pull their content and I interview their professors. I am now seeing theconversation.com articles appearing in US News and World Report. I am now seeing theconversation.com articles appearing in newspapers around the country. So it's not just on that site. It's not just in that silo. As you look at bifurcating your model so that you can do this investigative reporting, will you be able to use the content from your 501c3 in your more traditional newspaper? Or will there be a fire line between the two and you have to go to the 501c3 to access this information? Or can it be more of sort of be like more of a mugwump? It can go back and forth.
I would expect it to go back and forth. And I have four other newspapers involved in this project with us. And we're still putting it together, trying to get IRS approval, putting together the bylaws and the plan. But we absolutely need to be able to put this information. We can keep a lot of it, a lot of the public interest and public health reporting and the reporting on the Latino community, for example, outside of the paywall. We can make a lot of it available for free, but we're going to have to put some of it, for member and subscriber content. And then I think that what will happen is we'll be able to run a bifurcated model, you know, to retire some debt and do some other things for this collection of papers that's not owned just by my family. There's other owners of small papers in Iowa that are involved in this project with me. But eventually, you know, might be a 5 to 7 year window. I would think that the owners of the paper then would be looking at donating whatever value there is left of the papers into the nonprofit. So it's kind of a bridge. And we'll just see if the IRS agrees with the bridge concept. If they don't, then, you know, I mean, I've tried to be the anti-chain. Like we didn't, when this COVID-19 broke out, I didn't furlough anybody. I took my own money and put it into the newspaper's bank account so that I didn't have to lay off people. You know, like my sports editor is going to be a first-time father. You know, there's no sports in the spring and the summer, but we repurposed him. If he would have been working for a chain, they would have laid him off.
I know.
In Sioux City right now, which is a Lee paper, a former reporter from here, 30-year veteran, one of the best sourced reporters I know in Iowa, Woodbury County, the home of Sioux City, is a hot spot for COVID-19. And this reporter's furloughed, sitting at home, unable. I mean, he can't even like sort of sneak and write like non-byline stories because he'll violate wage and hour laws. The company won't let him do it. So to have one of the best reporters in Iowa in a hot spot, sitting at home right now is to me just outrageous. And it's not just about journalism. Now it's about public health because
life and death.
People trust us. People trust our newspaper because most of what they see in there, they can verify or it involves them directly.
Exactly.
So when we put state and federal guidelines in there, people read them with more of a local trusting eye. And so it's just tragic that a lot of these newspapers that are chain owned, you know, have their best people on the sidelines.
Well, what you represent is someone who's committed to the community, who's been in the community for almost 100 years, who's third generation. The community knows you. They know you from the past. They know you from the present. And they don't want to lose you in the future, Doug. And that's really what I'm getting the sense of. You have the third generation of leadership of the Carroll Times Herald. And as someone said, a gifted writer and columnist for the Western Iowa newspapers. They are very lucky to have you. Now the question is, do they understand why they don't just have you, they have to keep investing in you. And we have to be creative to do that going into the future. The pandemic is creating, I think, opportunities for entrepreneurship in so many new and different ways. And I think you've known it before, now you really know it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been great talking to you, and I hope to hear you more on the air in Iowa again. We have an important shared responsibility of keeping Iowa and New Hampshire first in the presidential vetting process. So maybe we'll be talking some more to make sure that we're first in line and that we continue our historical role.
Thank you so much for joining us, Doug, and good luck. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Arnie.
All right, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll talk tomorrow. Ciao.